So there's a fascinating machlokas between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria about the Tzvardea in Mitzrayim, Parshas Va'era. It's a bizarre machlokas. And what's even more intriguing is the language Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria dispenses to reject Rabbi Akiva's position. At some point, the Torah describes this wave, this surge of Tzvardea assault. And it's not clear, of course, I always have to remind people, it's not clear whether Tzvardea is a frog or Tzvardea is a crocodile, which makes it a little more ominous and a little more frightening. But either way, it's a wave. And they infiltrate the homes, and they infiltrate the palaces, and they infiltrate the ovens. It's all over the place. And they're croaking, and they're screeching. And yet the Torah describes them in the Lashon Yared, in a singular language. Vatal ha-tzvardea v'tachas. The Tzvardea arises and it covers the land. Now, there's nothing unusual about using a Lashon Yachid or singular language to describe a swarm or a surge. It happens in many places in Tanakh. But the Medrash senses something unique here. And the Medrash cites Rabbi Akiva. Tani Rabbi Akiva Omer. Tzvardea achas haisa. There was actually one humongous, gigantic frog or crocodile. Vihi hishritza Umala as Eretz Mitzrayim. This frog gave birth to millions of other frogs, which then covered the entire land of Egypt. So one Tzvardea arose from the Nile, one frog, one crocodile, and that one produced many, and that covered the entire land. Vatal HaTzvardea, the one humongous, huge, giant frog slash crocodile emerged, and then gave birth to literally, what was presumably millions of others, small ones, tadpoles and other frogs and other crocs, and they covered the land. Amrele Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria. Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria heard Rabbi Akiva said, he said, Akiva, Malach Eitzel HaGadah, why are you wasting your time with these crazy ideas of the Medrash? And it sounds like he was critiquing him on two levels. A is, why are you wasting your time? You're better outfitted to use your mental horsepower on what we would say is real halachos of negayim and ohalos. Real comes brings to mind the famous conversation between David and Hashem, where David says, I wish my tehillim should be as valuable to you and beloved to you as negayim and ohalos, as the technical laws of negayim, we would call it, of saras, tumah, that affect people, that affect homes, or ohalos, the laws of being found in the same structure as a mace, which are very, very technical and very, very demanding, and at least to the naked eye, not so relevant, because unfortunately people judge the relevance of Torah based on how relevant it is to our transient, fleeting world, rather than recognizing internal relevance to every word of Hashem's Torah, because it's Hashem's logic, and Hashem's logic is eternal, and therefore the relevance is internal and self-sufficient. But unfortunately people still use the yardstick from a temporal world to discover whether something is relevant or not. So people say, oh, Negayim and Olas is not relevant. How could it not be relevant? We don't ever have a case of Negayim, but it's Hashem's logic, so of course it's relevant. So David HaMelech was pleading with Hashem for Tehillim to be just as beloved to him as those who apply themselves, as we would call them, to Lamdos, and to understanding the deeper mysteries of Hashem's Ratzon. And at least according to Reb Chaim Volozhin, in the famous section in the Ruach HaNefesh HaChayim, Shaar Dalet, Hashem didn't answer David, which means he didn't accept that plea, because Hashem still considers technical Gemara learning to be superior to reading Tehillim or singing Tehillim. Very famous passage in the Nefesh HaChayim. So anyway, Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria tells Rabbi Akiva, you should go back to the Beis Medrash and give a shiur klali. You should go back to the Beis Medrash and become a lamdan. Kalei midrosecha. Stop with all this Haggadah. Lech etzel negoim v'olos. Tzvardea achas hoisa. You're right, there was one Tzvardea. V'sharka lehenuvau. And it really whistled, and all the other Tzvardeim came out following it. And that was how one became many. So this is a very, very colorful interaction. But the two parts that leap out at you when you read it is, first of all, what in the world is going on with one Tzvardea, either giving birth to millions of Tzvardea, or whistling and croaking and beckoning millions of Tzvardea? Why did Hashem choreograph a makkah like this? And presumably, a related question is, why was Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria so opposed to Rabbi Akiva's idea that he used such harsh language, such colorful language? Rabbi Akiva, you know, as we would say, this is not your forte. Stop offering drushas in medrash. It's like there were certain Tanaim and Amoraim whose forte was medrash, Rabbi Levi, Rabbi Simon, and we don't necessarily see that same spread, that same talent being expressed in halacha. And Elazar ben Azariah told Rabbi Akiva, you're the opposite. Spend your time helping us understand the mysteries, the depth, the legalities, but you're a little bit out of your field or out of your league when you're describing midrashim, which, by the way, as an aside, just reminds us that it's very rare to find people whose minds can encompass the entire sweep of Torah and different genres and different elements of Torah. You know, there are a lot of people who are providers of ideas, but their minds aren't equipped to be the microprocessors that are necessary to drill down to a sugya. And then there's some people who have great drill bits, and they're used to drilling down to sugyas and covering shas, but when they participate in the study of Jewish ideas, the range of Jewish ideas, sometimes that breadth is a little beyond them. Even within the world of Torah, poskim have a hard time being lamdanim. Lamdanim sometimes have a hard time being poskim. Lamdas tries to develop ideas. Halacha tries to prune. I like to compare the difference between lamdas and halacha, psak halacha. Are you a tree pruner or are you a branch grower? Poskim like to prune the tree and emerge with the trunk, and the trunk represents the consensus, majority, dominant, mainstream opinion. All the other branches are pruned away. This is the psak. And a lamdan tries to grow extra branches, and there are new ideas and new considerations and new concepts and new slants to Hashem's Ratzon, and they're all true, and they can't all be true halachically, because there's only one way to apply halacha, but they can be all true in the ideal mind of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is beyond binary experience. So, Rabbi Akiva was being told by his colleague, Elazar ben Azariah, the same Pesach colleague, he's being told, this is really not the area you should be offering. What was he so opposed to, and how is his superior? What difference does it make if the one huge frog gave birth to other frogs, or the one huge frog whistled and beckoned and drafted other frogs? I think the answer to all these questions is as follows. The plague, the event, the episode, you may have heard me before write this and say this, I dislike the word plague. The event of the Tzfardea was not only an attempt to punish Paro, not only an attempt to continue the assault on the breadbasket of the Egyptians, they couldn't cook their food in their ovens, not only to drive the Egyptians crazy, not only so many layers, but in particular, Tzfardea was an attempt to dispossess Paro of ownership of the natural force of nature, which was the Nile River. The Nile River was the source of Egyptian pride. The Nile River was the source of Egyptian economic superiority. This was how Pyro dreamed, standing by the Nile, the cows by the Nile, the stalks of wheat by the Nile. Just think for a moment of the satellite pictures of the dry and arid continent of Africa. Think for a moment of how, even to this day, people in Africa struggle to feed each other and to feed themselves and to acquire sweet water for irrigation, for agriculture, for life itself. And just think about how the top of that continent, near the Nile Delta, how fertile it is, Kigan Hashem, Ke'eretz Mitzrayim, and this was the source of it, presumably somewhat outlasting the famine in Bereshis. And throughout history, this was the source of Egyptian power, economic power, which of course can be parlayed into diplomatic power and into political power. And Pyro, who fashioned himself as a demigod, and rulers of the ancient world saw themselves as quasi-gods, as half-king, half-god, had appropriated the Nile as his. He saw himself as Pyro Omed al Hayor, as I'll take that phrase in Parshas Miketz as a metaphor, that he stands on the Yor and he controls the Yor. He's the reason the Yor issued such fertility and bounty, and every day visited the Yor in the morning, and that's where Moshe encountered him at the Yor, because this was a quasi-religious ritual in the morning for Pyro to reaffirm his, not just ownership, but his authorship over the fertility and the potential and the life-providing potential of the Yor. And Hashem is trying to, within Dam and Tzfardea, because Dam and Tzfardea must be seen as a tandem event. You can't just see these events as one-dimensional, but they link to previous ones. They're part of series. They're part of unfurl. They're part one and part two, and they're not necessarily adjacent. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is converting this source of life, of fresh, sweet, life-providing water into a river of death, of blood. The fish that are so vital to the Egyptian diet, because the Egyptians do not eat meat, red meat, so their primary source of protein, Their primary source of protein are the fish of the Nile, and now the fish have died and dumb. And of course, once the water is converted from a flowing river, a flowing stream of sweet water, into a stagnant, squalid pond of blood, it becomes a pond, and fish are replaced by reptiles, amphibians, whether it's frogs, whether it's crocodiles. So at some point, all their hopes about the Nile were dashed, and the Nile was no longer providing them all the bounty they had assumed it would continue to provide. And the Medrash senses this, that this is part of the dual attack, the dual assault, both of Dam as well as of Tzverdea. This is inherent in the Haftarah of Parshas Va'era, in which the Navi Yechezkel threatens Paro, who is crouching in the Nile, Asher Mali Oriv Ani Yasitini, I am the Nile is me, and I have created it. And Hashem basically plunders the Nile, fishes him out with hooks, if you're familiar with the Haftarah of Parshas Va'era, and it's latent in the Medrash. However, there's a second layer to that. And the second layer to that is not just that Hashem ransacks the source of Egyptian life and abundance and fertility, but also has to dispossess Paro of ownership. Because if we're just Hashem attacking the Nile, then Paro, thinking as ancient pagans thought, could have assumed that a stronger force had come, and a stronger force had come and taken over the Nile, and attacked it, and attacked their silos, and attacked their source of life, and he just had to summon a stronger army to defeat that force, or to wait till that force moved on to some other country or some other, because ancient warfare, you won some, you lose some, and there's always going to be an army stronger than you, or better armed, or better equipped. So the fact that the Nile River, through Dam and Tzverdea, suffered its plundering, and suffered this devastation, and suffered this decimation, wasn't necessarily going to switch Paro's mind completely from seeing himself as a demigod who controlled the forces of nature. He had to witness some other large force controlling the Nile. It wasn't enough for the Nile to be assaulted. There had to be some quote-unquote competitor to Paro. And this competitor couldn't be some other king or some other god. It had to be a part of the Nile, natural part of the Nile, that he realized that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the Nile, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered its power, its abundance, its sources, and he programmed it into nature. And Paro can't take possession of a system that Hashem created. Remember, these are things that are obvious to us, but this is the early stages of monotheism, and the pagan mind is still learning about monotheism. So it's not enough for Hashem to attack the Nile. So there's a strong king, a strong god, at this stage is stronger than him and attacked his precious jewel. Okay, there'll be a second round. There'll be a revenge war at some point. There has to be a rival power that's part of nature that controls and dictates the power and the fury of the Nile, and that demonstrates to Paro that this is internal to nature, and of course created nature, and human beings can't take possession, both physically as well as conceptually. That's why there has to be one huge, large frog. If it's just a wave of frogs, then once again, there's a force of the Nile. It's being summoned by some other king, the same king who afflicted the Nile, turned it into blood, is now summoning this nameless, faceless herd of frogs. There's an actual star frog, as we would say in a movie. Not just extras, millions of extra frogs being drafted into the movie lot. There's a star, Mr. Frog. He's going to win an Oscar Award, Academy Award. He's going to win an Oscar. And this frog has to rise from the Nile. This crocodile has to rise from the Nile and take control of the Nile and demonstrate to power that this is a force of nature that Hashem created, and nature controls itself. And of course, the HaKadosh Baruch Hu determines the rhythm of that control. And no human being can control it and can outcompete the forces of nature and can completely control the forces of nature. And that's what Rabbi Akiva and Elazar ben Azariah were both discussing, this one large frog. And that's why they both agree that it's one large frog. Now, what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was opposed to with Rabbi Akiva was he said, but wait a second. This other frog can't generate frogs asexually or ex nihilo. This frog has to summon them. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is demonstrating, my Sebrachus, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is demonstrating that he created nature and he created its force and that can't be appropriated by human beings. And it can't be controlled by human beings. So the notion that a frog, this one large super frog, would be able to spawn miraculously millions of other frogs in an unnatural way would defeat the entire purpose of this exhibition, of this presentation. So it's one thing for this super frog to beckon other frogs from the Nile, but it's another thing for this super frog to miraculously give birth, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is demonstrating this is the system of nature that I created, and human beings can't control it. They may be able to harness it, they may be able to exploit it, but they are never in control of it. And that's why there has to be one large frog, and that one large frog can't perform another miracle and generate other frogs. It's within nature. It has to create this event. And that's why it just summons frogs rather than giving birth to frogs. And that's why Elazar ben Azariah was so opposed to Rabbi Akiva's super frog conspiracy theory that one frog spawned millions of others. No, one frog summoned and whistled to other frogs to come. But they both agree that part of Makas Sfardea was demonstrating to Pyro that Hashem created natural systems which human beings can utilize but can't fully control and appropriate. And I think it's obvious some of the messages from Sfardea for the modern era in which we have exploited nature. We do feel that we are standing on top of nature. But every once in a while, an event like Corona reminds us that nature has its own internal forces and checks and balances, and we have a hard time wrapping our skills and our control around that. It's a fascinating, fascinating discussion about the super frog of Makas Sfardea. They both agree there was a super frog, and most of they agree with more than they disagree. Elizabeth and Isaiah just object to the super frog acting outside of the natural order and giving birth to millions of frogs.